The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning are famed Mad Magazine illustrator and cartoonist Al Jaffe and his biographer Mary Lou Weissman. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is the final Too Jewish show of the 2010 year, which means it must be time for our list of the top 10 Jewish stories of the past 12 months. Now, the truth is that this is not actually the end of the Jewish year. That won't come until the fall when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, in a very different way than we Americans celebrate New Year's. But since we are currently being richly drenched in end-of-the-year lists of bests and worsts, it isn't a bad time to review the past year from a purely Jewish perspective, or rather a too Jewish perspective. Or is it? Actually, most Jewish top story lists do come out in September, reflecting our focus on the High Holy Days as our real New Year. But the Simon Wiesenthal Center, perhaps the most prominent Jewish organization fighting anti-Semitism today, came out with its cheerful holiday season list of the top 10 anti-Semitic slurs of 2010. While there are no doubt were lots more to choose from, I will limit my own list to just the top 7 or so. After all, who needs more anti-Semitic slurs than that? And so, the top 7 anti-Semitic slurs of 2010, according to the Wiesenthal Center, are... Number 7, then-CNN correspondent Rick Sanchez, who said, "I'm telling you that everyone who runs CNN is a lot like Jon Stewart, and a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart, and to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority? Yeah." Number 6, Karl de Gucht, the European Union's chief trade negotiator, said, "Don't underestimate the power of the Jewish lobby on Capitol Hill. You shouldn't underestimate the grip it has on American politics, no matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats." Number 5, Thilo Sarrazin, the central bank senior executive for the German government, said, "All Jews have a certain gene that makes them different from other people." The number 4 top anti-Semitic slur of 2010 came from Al-Mutawakkil Taha, deputy minister of information for the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, who said, "The Jews have no historical or religious ties to the Temple Mount or the Western Wall. There is no archaeological evidence that the Temple Mount was built during the period of King Solomon." Number 3, former Malaysian Premier Mahathir Mohamad said, "Jews had always been a problem in European countries. They had to be confined to ghettos and periodically massacred. And even after the massacre by the Nazis of Germany, the Jews survived to continue to be a source of even greater problems for the world." The number 2 anti-Semitic slur of 2010 from the Wiesenthal Center, three-time Oscar-winning film director Oliver Stone said, "Hitler did far more damage to the Russians than the Jewish people. There is a greater focus on the Holocaust than on Russian suffering because of the Jewish domination of the media. And there's a major lobby in the United States. They stay on top of every comment. The most powerful lobby in Washington. Israel has effed up U.S. foreign policy for years." And finally, the Wiesenthal Center's most anti-Semitic slur of 2010 came from Helen Thomas, longtime UPI senior White House correspondent, first woman correspondent at the White House, and a regular feature of White House press conferences from Eisenhower to Obama. Helen Thomas in May said, "Jews should get the hell out of Palestine. They should go home to Poland, Germany, America, and everywhere else." She then compounded the idiocy by saying in December, was this her own May-December romance? Congress, the White House, Hollywood, and Wall Street are owned by Zionists. They put their money where their mouth is. Well, all of this anti-Jewish slander raises a few points. First, the most interesting fact is that in spite of his, spirited efforts while on spirits, former movie star Mel Gibson somehow did not manage to make the list of top anti-Semitic slurs of 2010. He'll just have to try harder in 2011, Mel. Although Jewish actress Winona Ryder's recent comment that you called her an oven dodger while drunk at a party 15 years ago does merit dishonorable mention. Second, although the Wiesenthal Center sees these many comments as indicative of a general acceptance in the mainstream of anti-Semitic speech, it's notable that the people who made these virulently anti-Semitic comments in America all paid a pretty high price for doing so. Rick Sanchez was fired by CNN. Helen Thomas was forcibly retired from her job of 50 years standing. And Oliver Stone, a tougher target than those, made two elaborate public apologies in order to get Abe Foxman of the ADL to give him absolution. It turns out that in the U.S., unless you're both as powerful and as clever as Glenn Beck, you really can't just get away with being an anti-Semite. My third point is that in the larger international realm, anti-Semitism, whether in its long-time ancestral homeland of Europe or in the huge Muslim world, is accepted and carries no great stigma. You can get away with it and even be celebrated for it in many quarters. And those quarters are not limited to Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran. All of which means we need a cheery play-in to improve our mood on this final Two Jewish Show of 2010. So here's my friend Rabbi Joe Black from his album Leave a Little Bit Undone, singing Banish Those Negative Thoughts.
Banish those negative thoughts from your heart. The words that we say, they can drive us apart. Don't let your anger take hold from the start. Banish those negative thoughts. Banish those negative thoughts from your heart. Set them free. Let them be. These pearls of wisdom I'd like to impart. Banish those negative thoughts. You know words are connected to strings. Can't take them back when we let them take wing. Instead of succumbing, now why don't you sing? Banish those negative thoughts. Succumbing now, why don't you sing? Banish those negative thoughts.
That was Rabbi Joe Black imploring us to banish those negative thoughts. Are you listening, Oliver Stone? Mel Gibson? Mel? When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guests, famous Mad Magazine illustrator and cartoonist Al Jaffe and his biographer Mary Lou Wiseman, creators of the new book, Al Jaffe's Mad Life. For all the irreverence and bizarre stories and jokes that Jaffe drew over the course of his long career at the very funny and deeply satirical Mad Magazine, nothing comes close to the wild and improbable tale of his own strange life, which he'll share when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I'm feeling lazy today and don't feel like writing a commercial. Instead, I'm going to read a letter we got the other day. Dear Mamas, thanks so much for your help recently when my car died outside your restaurant. But most important, thank you for the years of awesome service. You proved the difference between a good business and a great business is the people who run it. When I first walked into Mama's in 1982, I knew Mama and Pop were special. We used to chat while Mama made the pizza sauce and Pop told stories about pretty much everything. As we've gotten to know the rest of the family, I know Mama and Pop would be so proud of their legacy. Families like yours are hard to find, and we feel like we're a part of it. Thank you. Signed, Alex, Tracy, and Lexi. Well, guys, you are part of our family. And thanks for reminding us that it really is the family in our family business that's made Mama's what it is today. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Our guests, I should say, Al Jaffe, the very, well, I tell you, if you didn't grow up with Mad Magazine, you don't know what you were missing, but I did, and Al Jaffe's name and illustrations are imprinted in my brain from youth. Also with us this morning is Mary Lou Wiseman, who is the author of Al Jaffe's Mad Life, a new biography, a fascinating book, and it's illustrated by, of course, Al Jaffe. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, Al, I have to tell you, as I said, I've been reading your stuff, looking at your stuff ever since I was old enough to sneak my older siblings' copies. And a lot of people have been reading your Mad Magazine things for 50, 60, 55 years, is it now?
Well, it's Mad started in 1952.
So even longer. I didn't know any of this about you, but your personal story is utterly compelling and bizarre in a way. You were born in Savannah, an old and distinguished Jewish community, to a couple of immigrants from Lithuania, like so many American Jews, and your mother insisted on taking you back to Lithuania not once but twice. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, the first time was in 1927. My mother, I guess, had in mind to, or told my father that she was going to take us all to visit her relatives in the little town in Lithuania where they lived. And ostensibly it was, I think, supposed to be a vacation, of short duration to get to know the family and so on. Well, that turned into a year. And my father, who had remained in Savannah, became very anxious, and he decided to come over and schlep us back. So we did come back, and somehow my mother put away enough money, I guess, from the household money, secretly, I would suppose, and made arrangements to take us back again. I don't know if my father knew about the second trip or not, but in any case, we wound up spending another 4 years in Lithuania, and by that time, I think I became a little Lithuanian Jewish kid.
Wow. I mean, it's sort of the reverse migration. Everybody was either coming to America or trying to get to America, and your mom wanted to go back to the shtetl.
Al calls himself a reverse immigrant.
Yeah.
We were almost trampled in the stampede to come to America.
You were the only one swimming upstream.
That's right. That's right.
This ultimately really destroyed your family, didn't it?
Yes. It became a very dysfunctional family, and I think it was held together primarily because of my father's insistence and sacrifice. I mean, he never remarried. He never became involved with anyone. His entire life was dedicated to saving us, and he did at the sacrifice, really, of his own.
It's a really unbelievable story, and I think, Mary Lou, in capturing this, you start out with the concept of the plausible impossible, which tell us a little bit about that. It's certainly present in Al's work all through his career.
Yeah, well, this is a term of art in cartooning that was invented by Walt Disney himself, I think, in the 50s. And the minute I heard about it, I grabbed onto it because I thought it was just the perfect metaphor for Al's life. The plausible impossible in cartooning is when, say, for instance, Bugs Bunny is running at top speed and he gets to a chasm, and his little feet keep going around faster and faster and faster, and he leaps the chasm and continues running on the other side. Now, when you see that in a cartoon, it looks plausible, but of course it's impossible. He would have fallen in the chasm. For Al to have been taken away from his native land, brought effectively to into the 19th century, into a world lit only by kerosene, without houses, where the temperatures for a good part of the year were 20 degrees below zero, where he was starved, neglected, constantly covered by lice, and then 6 years later to be brought back to his homeland, to his native land, speaking English with a Yiddish accent. This is impossible. It's impossible. But in fact, it happened to Al. And what it did for him, what that kind of abandonment and displacement did for him, given his incredible intelligence and his talent to draw and to write, it has made Al a permanently displaced person, an alien. He is at home nowhere, which is his gift to us, because he can see through us, because he is such a stranger.
Yeah, you know, and of course the Jewish concept of a stranger in a strange land is so central. We will talk much more with Al Jaffe and Mary Lou Weissman. Al Jaffe's Mad Life is the book when we come back in a few minutes on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old, my wife is 86, and we like staying at Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo, they made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
Would you like to make a difference in this world without costing yourself anything? The Mitzvah Corps of Temple Emmanuel helps people in need with their mortgages and utilities and other emergencies of life. We've helped many people stay in their own homes and keep afloat long enough to get back on their feet. The Mitzvah Corps has virtually no administrative overhead and no long processing for those in emergency situations. Your state tax credit donation of $200 per individual or $400 per family costs you nothing. The Mitzvah Corps is a state tax credit 501c3 philanthropy, and your contribution is deductible right off your state tax bill and can also be used as a federal tax deduction. Consult your tax professional with any questions.
You can help the Mitzvah Corps help people in our community by sending your donation, check or credit card of $200 per individual or $400 per family to the Mitzvah Corps, care of Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road, Tucson, Arizona, 85716, or call 520-327-4501 for more information.
Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a unique and delightful evening of great wines, a wonderful meal, and the most unusual and pleasant holiday celebration of the year. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is coming to Temple Emmanuel on Friday, January 14th at 5:30 p.m. Tu B'Shvat celebrates the natural world and God's role in making it both beautiful and fertile. The Temple Emmanuel Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder, led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, features stories, songs, special foods, a delicious Shabbat dinner, and outstanding wines from the top kosher wineries in our taste-off of the best Israeli wines. Food and drink are from co-sponsors Pastiche, a modern eatery, and the new El Wine Bistro. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is followed at 7:30 p.m. by an all-music service for Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, featuring music of the great American Jewish composer Max Helfman. Registration includes all wine, food, and music. Call 327-4501 to sign up for the Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder at Temple Emmanuel on Friday night, January 14th. Call 327-4501 now to sign up.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us directly from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. On this final show of 2010, we look towards the new secular year and hope for a better 2011, a year of health, prosperity, and, well, luck. Here's the Sephardic singer Fortuna's lovely and spirited tune, Mazal. Luck.
Dios, dame un poquitito de mazal, échame en fundinos de la mar. Dios, dame poquitito de mazal, échame en fundinas de la mar. Dame poquitito de mazal, échame en fundinas del mar. Poquitito de masa, échame en fundinas del mar. Dios, dame un poquitito de masa, échame en fundinas del mar. Dios, dame un poquitito de
That was the Brazilian Sephardic singer Fortuna's song Mazal, Luck for the Coming Year. We welcome our expert on Israel, our maven, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there are many minority communities in Israel. We don't tend to think about them in America. You hear about Palestinians, you hear about Israelis, everybody thinks everybody in Israel is Jewish. And obviously about 75-80% of the population in Israel is Jewish, but then there's another 20%, which is like a million, million and a half people who aren't Jewish. Tell us about some of those communities.
Well, I would like to focus on a specific community of the Druze, because not many people know about the Druze. I think many people have heard about the Israeli Arabs and their internal conflict, whether are they Palestinians or are they Israelis and what.
Sure.
But I want to focus on our talk today on the Druze, who are a very small group, but very significant. The Druze live today in three regions in the world. They live in Israel, they live in Syria, and they live in Lebanon. Originally, the Druze were split from the Islam. And at their early years, they were, well, I don't have a nice way to say, they were hunted down by the Muslims.
Persecuted.
And they have run away all the way down to Egypt and then back up north. And because of those persecutions, they decided to keep their religion a secret. So they don't really let anyone to read their holy books. They don't let any youngster under the age of 40 to be able to read the holy books, even if he is Druze. But one interesting aspect of their belief is they're very loyal to the country in which they live. So the Druze in Israel, from the beginning, they came to the Israel government and said, we want our kids to join the army. We want them to be soldiers in the IDF. And today, we have very high-ranked officers in the army that are Druze. And if you go to visit, for instance, the village of Chulfesh, which is a Druze village at the up north, nearly every house in that village has a military car of an officer that lives there. So it's really outstanding.
Very interesting. You know, they often seem to me, the Druze in Israel, to be just an extraordinary community. I mean, very committed, very motivated, but also very clear on their Druze identity. And maybe that's an interesting lesson even for some of us Jews living outside of Israel. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant in the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6th. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. Although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about Israel's relationship with India and China last week, which brings up all kinds of interesting issues. Israel's forged a kind of very successful relationship with India now, out of nowhere. I mean, it didn't exist 10 years ago, I would say, or 15 years ago, certainly, in part because India certainly has some of the same problems with Muslim terrorists, with large Muslim nations around it that cause it to want to build common cause with other countries. But in general, very different kind of situation with China, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think you're right that Israel has been much more successful in reaching out towards India than it has in reaching out towards China. India, let's remember, is clearly more of an emerging superpower, whereas China has emerged. And the two will be rivals for control of their region. They certainly have lots of border disputes and lots of potential flashpoints that could start a war between them. In fact, World War III is most likely to start somewhere on the border between China and India. But
I hope it doesn't start at all. Just right. Want to get that in there.
I think you might not be entirely correct in characterizing India and Israel as having common interests vis-a-vis the Muslim world. I mean, Israel is surrounded by countries with which it has had a long, bitter history of enmity and suspicion, even if it has finally succeeded in establishing diplomatic relations with some of those countries, direct air links with at least Jordan and Egypt. I mean, air links is an interesting barometer always because you can study the history of Soviet foreign policy, for example, by simply taking the Aeroflot timetable for every year that Aeroflot existed and looking to see which destinations Aeroflot served and how frequently. I mean, any Russian hand can tell you that there's a lot of truth in this. So Israel and India do have direct civil aviation links, although only on El Al, not via any Indian carrier. Israel and China have on-again, off-again civil aviation links, again by El Al, which I believe serves Hong Kong currently, but nowhere else in China. The relationship between Israel and India is multifaceted. And first of all, there's a Jewish community in India, much of which has emigrated to Israel, as we saw recently at that fabulous Jewish food festival. Mm-hmm. There are trade links, there are military sales, there are investments in both directions. India and Israel share almost a trinopoly on the world diamond and diamond cutting industry. I mean, there's this sort of triangle between Antwerp, Bombay, and Tel Aviv. They have a lot in common other than their concern with the Muslim world. And that concern is also of a totally different nature because India's concern is with neighboring countries with huge Muslim populations like Pakistan, Bangladesh, Afghanistan, and India's own huge Muslim minority, probably 350 million people, whereas Israel's concern is with its Arab neighbors. So, you know, that's kind of one chapter. I think we should take a look at Israel and China next week and go into that in some detail as a separate topic.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish man excitedly tells his mother he's fallen in love and he's going to get married. He says, "Just for fun, Ma, I'm going to bring over three women. You try to guess which one I'm going to marry." The mother agrees. The next day, he brings three beautiful women in the house, sits them down on the couch. They all chat for a while. He then says, "Okay, Ma, guess which one I'm going to marry." She immediately replies, "The redhead in the middle." "That's amazing, Ma," the son says. "You're right. How'd you know?" The mother sighs, "Her, I don't like." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we continue with the truly greatest story ever told, the great Exodus narrative of slavery and plagues and liberation. As this week's portion of Va'era begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery, and the mysterious figure of Moses is returned to try to free them from bondage. In Va'era, God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants, or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, four more plagues will come: hail, locusts, darkness, all leading up to the climactic death scene of the slaying of the firstborn in the ultimate Exodus, the great moment in which our ancestors are freed from slavery, model for narratives of deliverance and emancipation ever since. These plagues are interesting in and of themselves. There are three sets of three plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity, every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was a principal deity of Egypt, as well as the source of its life and livelihood, and so, for the first plague, God simply turns it into undrinkable blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are turned next into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is a sacred beetle to Egyptians, symbol of Pharaoh's power, and insects are thus used to torment the inhabitants of Egypt. And so it goes. Sacred cows get diseases. The fertility of the land of Egypt itself is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, the solar disk of the sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are really a statement of theology, belief. There is only one God, and those who adhere to other gods and use their own power to enslave others will be overthrown with power and majesty. The arrogant will be overcome. Freedom will be guaranteed, and justice through the one true God will triumph. It's a message that still has resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule forever, that those who use their control for malign purposes are destined to flourish, we should reread this plagues narrative in Exodus. For at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. When we work to increase justice, we are simply doing the work for which we were made. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll talk again with the irreverent and very funny cartoonist and illustrator for Mad Magazine, the famous Al Jaffe, and his biographer Mary Lou Wiseman. His life story is more bizarre and astonishing than any of his many very funny creations over the years. Hear all about it when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It's always nice to start with good news. Apparently, the American Jewish population is larger than suspected, according to brand new estimates just compiled by Brandeis University. The suburban Boston University's Steinhardt Social Research Institute now estimates that there are some 6.5 million people in the United States who are either Jewish by religion or who self-identify as Jewish. This figure represents a 20% increase in the number of Jews since 1990. The numbers were drawn from a synthesis of data from more than 150 nationwide surveys conducted by the U.S. government and other agencies, as well as from national polling organizations. They refute information gathered in the last National Jewish Population Survey, a census-like study that had been conducted every decade by the Jewish Federation System before being discontinued this year. The final survey showed that between 1990 and 2000-2001, the population dropped from 5.5 million to 5.2 million. According to the study, 1.27 million Jews who identify by religion are younger than 18. The Steinhardt Center has not yet broken down other demographic data from the survey, but it will roll out more information about demographics, socioeconomic status, and other areas over the course of the next year, the center's director, Leonard Sachs, a former guest of Two Jewish, said. So, which is it? Are we an aging, diminishing population in America, or a growing, younger population? Apparently, it depends on who's doing the counting. In a follow-up to our Two Jewish story last week about the growing relationship between Greece and Israel, which is related to the declining relationship between Turkey and Israel, Turkey summoned Israeli ambassador Gabi Levy to the foreign ministry last week to convey its unease over a deal between Israel and Cyprus over economic rights in the Mediterranean. The issue comes in the context of the continuing erosion in Turkish-Israeli ties since Islamists came to power in Turkey, all of which was highlighted by the so-called flotilla incident back on May 31st. Turkish Foreign Ministry Undersecretary Feridun Sinirlioglu warned Levy the agreement would have an adverse impact on efforts to end the 36-year division of Cyprus between its Greek and Turkish communities, as though that were just about to end, of course. The leaders of the two Cypriot sides have been engaged in UN-sponsored talks since September 2008, with little tangible progress so far. As some of you may know, Cyprus has been divided since 1974 when Turkey invaded and occupied the northern third in response to an Athens-engineered Greek-Cypriot coup in Nicosia aimed at uniting the island with Greece. Turkey doesn't recognize the Greek Cypriot government in the south of the island, and Turkey remains the only country in the world to recognize the Turkish Cypriot statelet in the north. Anyway, the Cyprus-Israel deal signed in Nicosia last week defines the sea border between Cyprus and Israel and delineates an exclusive economic zone between the two countries, allowing them to search for energy sources in the eastern Mediterranean. It's another step in Cyprus's search for undersea oil and gas, following similar agreements with other countries, but it is also yet another sign that Israel is making continuing overtures to Turkey's historical archenemy, Greece. And just when you thought things were getting really good between Israel and Greece, a high-level priest on the morning show of the largest TV station in Greece blamed world Jewry for Greece's current financial problems. Lovely. The metropolite of Piraeus, Seraphim, also blamed world Jewry for other ills in the country during his appearance on Mega TV last week. Mixing Freemasons with Jewish bankers like Baron Rothschild and World Zionism, this august religious figure, the metropolite, said that there is a conspiracy to enslave Greece and Christian Orthodoxy. He then accused international Zionism of trying to destroy the family unit by promoting one-parent families and same-sex marriages. And just when you thought Jews couldn't agree on anything. 13 minutes into the program, the Greek host asked the metropolite, "Why do you disagree with Hitler's policies? If these Jews are doing all this, wasn't he right in burning them?" And the metropolite answered, "Adolf Hitler was an instrument of world Zionism and was financed from the renowned Rothschild family with the sole purpose of convincing the Jews to leave the shores of Europe and go to Israel to establish the new empire. Jews like Rockefeller, Rothschild and Soros control the international banking system that controls globalization," the psychotic metropolite also said. This high religious personage is not the only Greek priest with such extreme ideas. Salonika's metropolite Anthemos also has preached similarly from his pulpit. Just when you thought the Wiesenthal Center's top 10 list of anti-Semitic comments of 2010 was complete, a late entry rushes in and messes it all up. And in New York, the last remaining state of New York kashrut inspectors are going to be laid off as part of the continuing budget deficit crisis there. The kosher division has been drastically reduced in recent years from 11 full-time kosher inspectors down to 2, who received their pink slips in mid-December. The department has existed since 1915, 95 years, when a state law passed requiring inspections of kosher establishments, but it has been greatly diminished since a series of court challenges beginning in the year 2000. This now puts the full burden for certifying kashrut in New York onto the private certifiers and rabbinical authorities. And finally, Steve Landisberg, the actor who played the know-everything Detective Dietrich on the great Barney Miller TV show of the 70s and 80s, died last week at the age of 65. May his memory be a blessing. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Al Jaffe, the famous Mad Magazine chronicler of the implausible. His biography, Mad Life, a biography by Mary Lou Wiseman, is available now. It's a fascinating story, and it's not the usual kind of biographies we were talking about earlier. Al, you were brought back to America from this Lithuanian sojourn, which is really, in many ways, your formative years. As Mary Lou said earlier, you became kind of a ger be'eretz nochria, a stranger in a strange land. They spoke Yiddish in Lithuania. Had you lost your English when you came back to the States?
No, I didn't. Fortunately, My mother insisted on speaking English at home, and so my brothers and I not only learned to not only kept up with our English speaking, but we also learned to read and write English to some extent.
You don't really know what happened to your mother. Likely she was killed by the Nazis because, of course, she didn't leave Lithuania.
That's correct.
The town that you lived in, essentially every single Jew was murdered.
Yes.
How does that feel?
Well, it's one of those things that you either push it back and into the back of your mind, or you dwell on it and go nuts. So I think I decided not to go nuts, and I just have pushed it into another world. I mean, there are tragedies. The world is full of tragedy, and how much of it can you carry on your back?
Al, tell us a little bit about Mad Magazine. It seems to me that Mad Magazine is the kind of magazine that strangers in a strange land make about the strange land in which they live.
I wish I could take credit for the creation of Mad Magazine, but I can't. It was created by a very good friend of mine, Harvey Kurtzman and Willie Elder, and very, very talented people. I came on board a couple of years after they had created it. The creator of MAD told me that he had wanted me from the beginning, but he couldn't get me. But MAD, I think, has been a wonderful thing for the country as a whole, and even internationally, because I get a lot of emails from places in Europe where young fans are collectors, and they have my work and others. I think MAD set a tone in the United States during very difficult times, which was the McCarthy era, when, just pointing a finger at someone and saying he's a communist ruined that person's life. And MAD made fun of that kind of stuff. And it managed to, I think, open people's eyes to the fact that everything you hear, you don't need to believe everything you hear or listen to anybody who's pointing fingers at somebody else, because there's a lot of craziness going on. And I think the magic of MAD was that while it was exposing the nuttiness that goes on in politics and in celebrity worship and stuff like that, the number one purpose for doing what MAD has been doing was to get a laugh. It wasn't WikiLeaks. It was just to get laughs by showing people, pretentious people, whether they're politicians or celebrities, and showing, bursting their pomposity. So it's been great fun for me. I mean, it prevented me from going into mental therapy, because I could get all my aggressions out there.
I was thinking MAD was probably your therapy.
It was my therapy. I mean, when I, created snappy answers to
stupid questions.
I mean, what a great outlet that was for venting my spleen.
Do you have a favorite snappy answer to stupid questions out of all the ones you did?
That's a tough one.
How about your inspirational one, Al?
Which
How about the one about Richard? because I think it's fun for people to know how you got the idea for Snappy Answers.
Well, yes, I think that probably the thing that inspired the whole business is I lived in Long Island, and Long Island had frequent electrical storms, and during the period that I lived there in the 1960s, everyone had a TV antenna, and my antenna was constantly being knocked over. It was attached to the chimney, it was bent over. And I had to borrow an extension ladder from a neighbor, climb up. I'm terrified of heights. I would hold on to the chimney for dear life and try to straighten the antenna. And on one occasion, I hear footsteps on the ladder in back of me, and when the footsteps arrive at my feet, a voice says, "Where is Mom?" It was my son, 10-year-old son. And I'm shaking with fear up there, and I said, "I have killed her, and I am shoving her down the chimney." At which point, the feet retreat very rapidly down the ladder. My son didn't speak to me for a while. But I...
that is probably not in the handbook of good parenting, but...
No, it's not. But it's in the handbook of getting good ideas from Mad Magazine.
Absolutely.
So I thought about it, and I said, everyone is asked questions either to which the answers are either obvious or there's no way that you would know the answer. And you're just bothered by it, and you just, you wish you could tell people, go away, don't ask those stupid questions. How should I know the answer? And so I thought maybe it would make an article just to do it for fun, not to get out any kind of aggression, but just to take typical questions like, your mother opens the door and you're lying with your face buried in the pillow, and she says, "Are you asleep?" Well, what are you supposed to say to that? I think my answer was, "No, I'm dead. Leave the flowers and get the hell out of here."
But I want to thank Al Jaffe and Mary Lee Wiseman for a great visit. We go on for a long time. The book is called Al Jaffe's Mad Life, a biography written by Mary Lee Wiseman, illustrated beautifully, brilliantly, as usual, by Al Jaffe. It's available everywhere. Amazon's probably a good place to get it. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And Al, don't retire ever. I just want to pass that on.
Oh, I don't think I... The owner of my mortgage will not allow that.
And Mazel Tov on the book.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
Attention Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, formerly known as Cheder. Here's how. The state of Arizona private school tax credit allows Arizona taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, allowing scholarships for children in kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at the Tucson Hebrew Academy and the Jewish Community Center. If you make your donation today, you'll get 100% of your money back on your Arizona state income tax. A tax credit is not a deduction. Rather, it's money that comes directly back to you in your state tax return. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. The deadline to take your tax credit is December 31st, so call or sign up online now.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Neil Goldberg, creator and impresario of all the Cirque productions. Our playout this morning comes from cantor David Dudu Fisher, the great Israeli cantor and musical star. His tune for the new year, this time a secular one, Shana Tova. Have a good new year. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good secular New Year's. Drive safely, it's on Shabbat this time around, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shana Tova, Shana Tova, Anava Rabba Hinekreva, Avislicha, Dam Ahava, Avi Pius, Vegam. Yamim holchim, yamim baim, silchi gam at lachataim, rab icholim, simchi noflim, bechesedu.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.